We're up to the last section here in the first well. Before we go on to well. Okay. The if you recall, the question in this Be'er, the question in this well that was most concerning them, and we've gotten a little bit off that subject directly, you know, in the travels through this section, was that the Torah says, Lois Baltaisif, the Torah says Baltigra, and you're not supposed to add, you're not supposed to detract from the Torah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave to the Jewish people. And the way it seems that the Chachamim function is that we have the Torah of Moshe, and the Chachamim came and they sort of like redo things, they make their own rules. So what is it? How could it be? How are the Chachamim doing it? Whether the Chachamim are adding to the Torah, or whether the Chachamim are taking away from the Torah. And if you remember earlier on in this Be'er, we learned about the various categories, what the Chachamim are doing, and how it's really integrated within the Torah to safeguard the Torah, you know, like the eyelids, you know, to protect the eyes, and so on and so forth, all that, those kinds of things. Since then, we've gone a little bit off the subject with our discussion, with the discussion about difference of opinion, and so on and so forth. But now he's coming back to deal with another facet that he hasn't dealt with yet, which is Yiro'o, the Chachamim taking away from the Torah. Not the Chachamim adding and saying that while the Torah says you can do this, but you just can't do that, we say you shouldn't do this either. The Torah says you shouldn't eat meat with milk, we say you shouldn't eat chicken with milk either. Here we're talking about the Chachamim taking away. And the classic example from which he asks is, HaTorah Amra, the Torah says, Arboim Yakenu. The Torah says you should give him 40 lashes. Vehem amru mispar hamakais lamites. And the Chachamim said that the number of makais, the number of lashes which are given to the person, are actually 39. How does that work? How do the Chachamim come and change from the way the Torah itself seems to say it? So let's take a look first at the sources in order to be able to approach this properly. Perek Chaf Hei, chapter 25 in Devarim, discusses the din of Malkus, the din of lashes. Lashes were given by the Torah. Again, this is something which it takes the Chachamim to read the Psukim and be able to arrive at this conclusion. Not simple from the reading of the Pasuk. The Pasuk speaks about Ki Yiriv Ben Anoshim, when there's an argument between people, V'nikshu El HaMishpat U'Shvatum, they come to the judge and he judges them, V'tzdiku Es HaTzadik V'Yirshu Es HaRasha, they declare the righteous side and the guilty side. V'hoya Im Bin HaKais HaRasha, and it says, if the guilty side is one who is deserving of being hit, deserving of lashes, V'Pilo HaShofet V'Yiko L'Funav K'dei Rishasav B'Mispar, and the Shofet, the judge, has him, so to speak, fall. He goes in a downward position and he lashes him before him, k'dei rishasa, according to his guilt, b'mispar, with number. New verse, arboim yakenu, 40 times he should hit him, lo yosef, he should not give any more. Pen yosef la'kais alele makarabba v'nikla chicha le'inach, lest he do additional ones and the brother will be, your brother will be, Nikla is like made the light of, will be humiliated before your eyes. And then, before the paragraph ends, the verse says one more line, Losach sam shor bedisho, do not muzzle an ox while he is threshing. What does that have to do with anything? So in fact, the sages use that verse very importantly, and they say, you want an example, you said, if he deserves lashes, you want an example of when he would deserve lashes, it would be when he transgresses on this kind of a prohibition. A lo saseh, a prohibition that carries no further punishment, no specific punishment. It's a prohibition which is transgressed actively. Lav sheyesh bo maisa, you do an action, you put a muzzle on the animal, not allowing it to eat while it's doing the work, which is considered a torture to the animal, and therefore the one who did it gets malchus, gets lashes. And it says in the verse, what did it say? You should give him lashes, k'dei rishasai, according to his guilt, b'mispar, by number. And then the new verse, 40 times you should give him, lo yais, if you should not add. Rashi, right away, says, b'mispar, b'ein einokud b'mispar. It says, b, with a shva, it doesn't say ba. Ba, bimispar would mean by number. Ba mispar would mean by that number, or by the number, the definite article, referring to something specific. Right? That's why we correct Balei Kriya when they say bi instead of ba, or ba instead of bi, because it's a different word. Right? One of them, and then a different meaning. One of them is just in it, and the other one says in that specific one. So it doesn't say the specific one. Lomut shudavuk leimar bimispar arboim, leiboim shalemim. So the way he reads it is with the number 40, 40-ish. Not exactly 40, not the definite 40. Ele minin shu seichem mashim arboim. 40-ish, something which could be rounded off, which is 40 minus 1. That's what Rashi says. Right? What does this mean? What is the idea behind this? Why would the Chachamim read it this way? And it's especially intriguing, you understand, because there's a prohibition against doing extra. What happens if you give 40 malchus? You're giving extra. Right? You're giving one extra. And that would be already chayv malchus. This is the way the Torah learns from the prohibition against hitting somebody. Because if you can't hit him in court when he's deserving lashes, you give him one more, you're punishable. So imagine if you just give him a slap in the face in the street, you know, then certainly there's going to be a problem. So pen yosef lahakaisai. So this is the verse, and it's hard to understand. The Torah says 40, and the Chachamim make it 39. What's the idea? Where does this come from? How does it work? It's a good question that people have on the Chacham. How do they make this happen? Okay, so the next level of source that we have to look at is the Gemara. The Mishnah and the Gemara in Makkos. The end of Makkos. Makkos is about lashes. Okay, now it's not just about that. It starts off with discussion really about other stuff, but it ends up being a discussion about it. Okay. The Mishnah says, "Kama malkan I say, how many lashes do we give him? Arboim chaser achas. This is Chav Beis Amar Aleph and Makkos. 40 minus 1, 39. Shneamar b'mispar arboim, minyan shu seichem l'arboim. A number that approximates arboim. Why does it say b'mispar arboim? Why does it just say arboim yakenu? Kedei rishasay arboim yakenu. Give him 40. It says b'mispar arboim." With the number 40. So we say that implies a number that approximates 40, close to 40, pretty much 40. Rabbi Yehuda Eimer Arboim Shleimei Sulaika. Rabbi Yehuda disagrees with this, and he says you get 40 on the nose. Vehechan Ulaika, Esayisera, where does he get the extra one? Bank Seifov. You give him the extra one between his shoulders. The idea is that we learn, really, in the Dinim over here, that there is the Malkus we're given 13, 13, 13. Three sets of 13. That makes 39. Rav Yehuda agrees with that in principle. However, he says there's a 40th. So the 40th is given in a separate installment to a certain degree in a separate place. Okay. Now, the Rashi explains over here as well. It doesn't say hit him 40 times by number. So we hear from that, so he focuses less on the biba as in the order of the words in the verse. But again, it's just taken as an approximation of sorts. So the Gemara says, my time. What's the reason why we say 39 rather than 40. Okay, so you understand the flow of what's happening over here. This is we read the psukim, we read the verses. Right, we saw Rashi's comment, which Rashi is basically trying to give a rendition of what we find in the Gemara. But Rashi is a commentary of later generations, of many, many hundreds of years later. The Mishnah is the first commentary on the Torah Shebaal Peh that we use. The Gemara explains the Mishnah. So the Mishnah brings that the Chachamim say that it's 40-ish, that it's 39. The Gemara says, where do they get it from? Iksiv arboem b'mispar havamina arboem b'minyana. Hashtiriksiv b'mispar arboem minyan shusechem sarboem. Had it said 40 in number, we would have said it's 40 exactly. But if it says a number of 40, so that sounds more like it's ish. Amar Rava, Rava says, kamatip shoy sharinchi, the kaimi mikami sefer Torah, like kaimi mikami gavar rabba. How foolish are these people that stand up for the Torah scroll, but don't stand up in front of a great man, in front of a Torah scholar. Dilu b'sefer Torah k'siv arboim v'asu rabbanan batzru chada. In the Torah it says 40, and the rabbanan say 40 minus 1. So, you see, the rabbanan's impact, the rabbanan's relationship to the Torah. We will come back to this statement, Emir Tashem, a little bit later, towards the end of our discussion. But meanwhile, this is what we have. This is how the Gemara explains from a nuance in the verse. Rashi and Chumash seems to use a little twist on a nuance in the verse. There's other nuances that some say we find because it's not divisible. 39 is divisible by 3, and since we have proof in the pasuk, reading in the verse, subtleties in the verse, that it has to be ru'im lehishtalesh, it has to be divisible into 3 separate things, so it needs to be a kind of number that is a multiple of 3. But the Maral is not satisfied simply with just saying, okay, here we have this technical reading of the verse. He does bring it, of course, and he does add to the nuances of the technical reading, and he does it inside. I'm not sure how much time we're going to spend on it because of the the linguistic issues are not good for helping eyes glaze over. Mm-hmm. The Maral, however, speaks here conceptually about why it would be that while the Torah says 40, we would take it as 40 minus 1. Not as 39 almost, but as 40 minus 1, although 39 is 40 minus 1. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that would be a step before 40 rather than 40 itself. And the Maral explains as follows. Ki amakubal etzlan, ki mispar amakais arboim, kineged yitzira sa'odam shanaitzar barboim yayim. The number of 40 makas is corresponding to the 40 days that it takes for a child, but what you would call just a fetus, the basic beginnings of a fetus to form. From the time of conception until 40 days, it's not considered really to have any form whatsoever. It's just like water, maya ba'alma. While there is, of course, microscopic form, but at that point of mispar arboim, of 40 days, that's when we start saying that there is a fetus in there, rather than there's just some foreign liquid substance that's taking place in there. It has, to some degree, halachic consequence. For instance, the halacha of yoledes, a woman who's given birth, right? The tumah, the impurity that's associated afterwards, that she has to separate from her husband temporarily, applies even in most cases, in many, many cases, I should say, to miscarriages. However, before 40 days, she's not even considered a yoledes. That's considered just maya ba'alma. It's considered just to be water. And Chazal understood that the 40 days, the 40 lashes, rather, that are going to be brought here upon the sinner, the person who did this specific wrong, is going to be corresponding to these 40 days of Yetziras Havlad, the 40 days of formation. This is not new. We have the same thing with the 40 days and 40 nights of the Mabul, of the flood, which also to a certain degree was this idea that it was either because, in the negative sense, the people had sinned very much in the areas of morality affecting conception, and therefore they had to have their purification in the same way. Or more positive framework, the idea was that what was being conceived really through the Mabul was scratching the world's first version and generating a new world, creating a new world. So it was the 40 days that was the Yetziras Havlad, the formation of the new world order that would come post Mabul. Likewise, you have the 40 days and 40 nights that Moshe Rabbeinu spent on Har Sinai. Similar idea, that the 40 days and 40 nights were there in order to create, to incubate and develop this new Beria Chadasha, Kikaton Shenoladami, like the child that's reborn, is what the Jewish people are described as, what anybody who joins the Jewish people is described as, joins the covenant with Hashem. It was a new creation, 40 days and 40 nights of development that way. And in a sense, Moshe Rabbeinu then had to go through 40 days of undoing the harm of the golden calf, and then start again a new 40 days to re-create the connection with Hashem afterwards. So, doing and undoing. In fact, the Gemara has an opinion that the 40 days which we have post-birth, where the Torah says there are 40 days post-birth, when a person gives birth to a boy, so for 40 days she is not achieving her full purity, right? She has a degree of purity to her husband already after 7 days, if she's, according to our custom, she's not bleeding anymore, but 40 days she's not able to return to the Beis HaMikdash. And the Gemara says to a certain degree that could be because it corresponds to the 40 days of the creation of the child. So much so that the Gemara has an opinion that says, well, maybe by a girl where it's 80 days, it's because maybe it takes 80 days to develop a female and 40 days to develop a male. The Gemara doesn't really end up that way. It describes different experiments and things that they did to be able to determine this. But the idea is, again, on some level, that there's again a recreation, a regeneration to be able to come again. The 40 years that the Jewish people spent in the deserts, the 40 days that the spies were going to conceive of how the Jewish people would be able to take Eretz Yisrael. Wherever you find that number, the magic number 40, to a certain degree it's going to be associated with this idea of generation, of creation. Says the Maral, now let's look at those 40 days. Those 40 days, it's going from what to what. The first 39 days, he's going to separate from the last day. That's basically going to be the outline of what the Maral is trying to do. That when you have something going from a state which is just undefined, unformed mass, unformed matter, when it finally reaches that stage, is on the 40th day, is on the closing point. So, therefore, you could speak about the first 39 in one category, and the 40th in another category. That's basically the principle, the idea that the Maral speaks about. If you go on day 39, and you see this fetus, even though, of course, we understand that it's more developed than it was on day 1, but nevertheless, it is still considered shapeless. It's still considered just chomer. It's just considered just the matter by itself. It only has its tzura. It only has its finished shape, its finished form, when it reaches that 40 days. And then it gains that status. So the Maral takes this, and he describes it, and the way he understands it and explains it is as follows. This passage, by the way, in the Maral is found here in a little bit of a greater length, but it's found somewhat more concise and straight in the Maral's commentary on Rashi, the Gur Aryeh. The Maral wrote a running commentary on Rashi called the Gur Aryeh, and it's found there in Dvarim Perek Chafei, where the verses in the Torah, and Rashi makes his comment. So the Maral brings all the different interpretations of the technical reading of the verse to make it 39 instead of 40, and then he says, but the idea is this. This is where they got it from, and he explains it this way. A human being is made from chomer, is made from, you know, basic matter. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes and puts into him and forms him and makes tzura. We've talked before about Chaymer Tzura, right? In this shiur, I think we've talked before about Chaymer Tzura, the difference between, or the two elements of matter and form. You take a gob of Play-Doh and you put it on the table. That's Chomer, that's raw matter. You sit and you mold it and you shape it into a man, into a car, into a whatever it is that you want to form it into. And now, it's the same matter. The matter was there before, but you have put upon it the imprint of Tzura, the imprint of form, and you've made it into something different. When it comes to Bria, when it comes to creation, it's the same thing. The first creation that HaKadosh Baruch Hu made in the world was Chaymer, was he created matter. Gracious Bara Elohim as Hashamayim Vesaret. In the beginning Hashem created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was Tayu Vavayu. It was empty and void and darkness and so on and so forth. So if you read this verse, you read it with the Rishayim, like the Ramban, so he says, what's the idea? That the beginning, the creation of the heaven and the earth was, he created the Chomer, the raw matter of the earthy beings, and the raw matter of the heavenly beings. And what is the raw matter of the earthy beings composed of? So we have four categories. What are the four categories? Afar, dust, Mayim, water, Ruach, wind, and Esh, and fire. So he says, so if you look in the Pasuk, that's what it says. The earth was Tayu Vavayu, it was empty and nothing, in other words, shapeless, no Tzura. V'chayshech al p'nei sahayim, v'ruach elekim racheves al p'nei amayim. Chayshech is darkness, which is, the way the Maral, the way the Ramban understands it, is sort of like the anti-esh, right? It's from the fire component. Al p'nei sahayim, on the face of the tahayim, of the depths. The depths is the seabed, so to speak, the earth. And then there's the mayim, the water, with the wind, the ruach elokim, hovering above it. That's the basics. We're not going to get into the details of what this means. These are all matter. We see matter, we see the earth, we see the water, whatever it is, the raw elements. Right, we're not going to talk about the wind and the fire right now. Right, we'll save that for a 70s rock concert. The idea is, however, that it's describing the world first, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu just brought the matter, the raw matter, into existence. And then what happens is HaKadosh Baruch Hu starts to put an imprint on it, to shape it. That's why we say that really the term Bria, creation, was only used at the beginning. We find a couple of times later in the story where the term is used again, and each one has its own explanation. But the understanding is that Bria fundamentally is Yesh Me'ayin, creating something out of nothing. If we were sitting here like this here at the table, and suddenly a ball of Play-Doh appeared out of thin air, not from your sleeve, not from my sleeve, not from the false tile in the ceiling, but it just, boom, there it was, that would be Bria. The matter came out of existence, out of nowhere. It doesn't happen. Sorry, excuse me one second.
It looks like Rabbi Gottlieb appeared out of nowhere. How does he do that? I'm just not sure how a Village People concert is going to help, but my understanding is.
Village People.
Isn't that what he was talking about?
Sorry, excuse me. Again, you're creating the chaymer, you're creating the matter out of, where was I?
Yesh me'ayin.
It's something coming out of nothing. That's Bria. Bria is something out of nothing. When the gob is sitting here already, and I'll tweak it, and you'll shape it, and we'll do the thing, that's not Bria. We're not creating something. What we're doing is we're forming. That usually we associate with the term Yetzira. Asiya would be finishing, right? Yitzir would be forming. We would make it if we would then want to go and take it to a kiln and bake it so that it would be holding that shape. We would call it then asiya, finishing it. Yitzir is forming. But there you're working with existing matter. So we understand that fundamentally, creation as in yesh me'ayin, as in ex nihilo, right? That something out of nothing was the first burst to create the chaimer. And then from then on, HaKadosh Baruch Hu went and he refined it and he formed it and he developed it. Not the kind of refining and forming that we would do, you know, like with a gob of clay, though it's still very divine. It's the kind of forming and development that could only be accomplished by a divine hand. But nevertheless, it is working within already existing parameters. That's Chomer versus Tzura. Bayre mine mezaynes. Bayre mayre ha'esh. By lechem it's different. Hamoitzi lechem in har, it's correct. It's a very, very good question, and you will find in general that it has to be explained. I'm not going to explain it right now, but the way the terms are sometimes used is not always you have to figure it out. Yaitzer Oyer Uvayre Choshech, right? So that would be a beautiful illustration of what we're talking about, because originally what was the unformed matter was the Choshech Al Pnei Sahom, and then what did Hashem do? He or, right? So he was Yotzer, that was already forming, working, using the elements. Can we, whatever, each one needs to be explained. Your question is a good question. But folk, let's come back here. So we have the Chaimer, creation of the matter, and then the formation of the matter. Chaimer, the matter itself, is viewed in the negative sense. And we talked about Tzimtzum, right? I'm going to go over it, I think. But I think we talked about this idea of Chaimer. We never did before? Okay. Are you sure? Did we? Do I remember? Never Tzimtzum? Huh? Okay. Tzimtzum, right, if you want to, like make it in that high-flying Kabbalah world, so you need a few words, okay? You know, like if you happen to be sitting next to Madonna on an airplane or something like that, you want to talk like things you have in common, just drop Tzimtzum, okay? Tzimtzum. Okay, this is it. Okay, Tzimtzum is Kabbalah 101. What's Tzimtzum? Tzimtzum means literally contraction. Tzimtzum literally means contraction. So what is the idea of contraction? Is that we say that in order for God to create the world, God had to contract. He had to shrink. He had to shrink to make room for the world. What's the idea? God is overwhelming in His presence. Ata ha'reisa l'das ki Hashem hu ha'elokim ein oid milvada. You have been demonstrated, it has been demonstrated to you, you have been shown, so that now you can know that Hashem is the Elohim. There is nothing other than He. Ein od milvado. Right? It's a verse in the Chumash. Some people say it. Nusach Sfarad says it every time you take out the Sefer Torah. Nusach Ashkenaz says it Simchas Torah. Ein od milvado. There's nothing other than Him. What do you mean there's nothing other than Him? How about you? How about me? How about this table? How about this earth? How about the galaxies and the solar systems? So of course on one level, what we mean is that nothing exists that's not dependent on Hashem. Einod milvadai would mean not that there is nothing other than Hashem, but in a deeper meaning, there's nothing other than Him, because everything that exists only exists because He made it exist. And not only because He made it exist, but because He continues to make it exist. And if Hashem would remove the energy, the power that gives it existence, it would disappear. So while in a certain sense you could say, you exist, I exist, but on the other hand you would say that since that is all completely dependent on Hashem, so we could say really that Hashem is the only one that really, really exists, and everything else comes along. On another level, however, Hashem did leave room for us to exist. And He didn't even just leave room for us to exist, but He also gave us a remarkable amount of independence, like free will, things where we're able to affect things, where we're able to change things, where in a certain sense Hashem even gave us a certain leadership power that He's going to do based on what we do. We affect and we change the world. So, what you have to do is, And here now a new side of Yesh Me'ayin. Ayin is Ein, right? To create something out of nothing means that there was nothing other than Hashem, and now you have to create the possibility that something can exist other than Hashem. It's not just, oh, there wasn't a gob of clay dough here, and now we have to make a gob of clay dough. If we had that, we would say, okay, fine, so you're creating something out of nothing. But there was nothing about us being here that made it that this thing of clay dough couldn't exist. It's just that there happens not to be right now a thing of clay dough in the middle of the table. And in a second, boom, there will be a piece of clay dough. But here, you're dealing with the fact that Hashem's presence is so far-reaching, so complete, that is there really room for anything else to exist? Just like the Jewish people were worried about encountering Hashem at Har Sinai, how can we survive the encounter? Can anything exist in the presence of Hashem? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu, however, wanted to create. He wanted something to exist, so to speak, other than Him. So Hashem had to, so to speak, make it possible for something else to exist. And He had to contract and allow this otherness to come into existence. That's Tzimtzum explained by a non-Kabbalist. Okay, that's Lithuanian Tzimtzum. Okay? So,
who's Canadian?
So, I'm fine. So so now let's read again the verse in the beginning of the Torah. Vayomer Elokim Yehi Shamayim Vaaretz. Oops, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say, and God said, let there be a heaven, let there be an earth. Every other creation, virtually, it says, and God said, let there be. By Bereshis, it doesn't say it. It says, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. In fact, if you would read Rashi's translation of the verse, it wouldn't even say that. It would say, in the beginning of God's creation of the heaven and the earth, as if we are joining this program already in progress. Right? We don't even describe the moment, the instant of creation, according to Rashi's translation of the verse. Why the differentiation?
Isn't that one of the Asar Mamar also?
Yes. Bereshis Nami Maimar. We say that when we speak about the 10 stages of creation, the 10 statements, quote-unquote, of creation, Bereshis also is on that list. But it wasn't as an explicit Vayomer. It wasn't as an explicit statement. We do say, Baruch Sha'amar V'hoya Ha'olam, right? But on the other hand, when we read in the verse, it doesn't give it explicit nature of a mimer. And the idea is, it would seem, that because, in fact, the difference between the creation of matter and the creation of form is that matter came into existence by Hashem pulling back and therefore allowing the matter to come into existence as an independent thing. And then once that matter, that ball of clay dough, came onto the thing, then Hashem reached back from, so to speak, His area, and He started to shape it and form it. In a sense, Hashem's creation of matter is by Hashem stepping back and limiting Himself to allow it to be, whereas afterwards His forming of that matter is by imposing something on it. This is an idea, and I want you to try to retain it, okay? In whatever way you can, review it, because we will. I think it's a yesod. It's a foundation in reading the Chumash, the beginning of the Chumash. We've all gotten that far, and at the same time, it gives us the following basic insight into the human dynamic of challenge, of Yetzer Tov, Yetzer Ra, of trying to make right decisions, the dynamic we've been talking about since the first day with the heart and the intersection between the body and the soul. Because what happens is, if you want to think about where this dynamic comes from, we have so much of us that is godly, and we have so much of us that seems to be just much more basic, material, and ungodly. What is the godly and what is the ungodly? What is pulling us to do the good and what is pulling us to the bad? Right? Not the angel, with the halo and the one with the forked red tail, right, and the pitchfork. The chaimer, the matter, was from Hashem saying, you know what, I'm every place. I'm going to step back and let something exist that's completely other than I. And that is the root of that which would be and which would manifest itself over time in that which is other than Hashem. On the other hand, once Hashem started forming and putting of himself in, then we start to have the goodness. What was the first insertion that HaKadosh Baruch Hu put into the world? What is the first mamar kimashmo? What was the first explicit statement? What is the first Vayomer Elokim?
Yior,
let there be light. What was that light? Now, if you say sunlight, I'm going to ask you a big question. Because the sun wasn't created till the fourth day. Right?
The absence of darkness.
It was created on the first day, wasn't it? Put into place.
It was created, as they say, and then it was only hung in the heavens. What exactly does that mean? Chazal say it was the Or Hagonos, the Or that would be hidden away for the end of days. But you know something? If you will go and study, whether you'll study your Siddur, or you'll study the works of the Balim, of the Zohar, which means, by the way, what does Zohar mean?
Light.
Light. Right? Or you'll learn the Derech Hashem of the Ramchal, and he's going to talk about physicality versus spirituality. What is he going to speak about? The lightness versus the darkness. What do we say in Sim Shalom, the last bracha of the Shemoneh Esrei during the daytime? Bless us by the light of your countenance, because by the light of your countenance you have given us the Torah, the love of kindness, and so on and so forth. Light is not just fluorescent, halogen, sun. You know, light is the physical expression, so to speak, which we use to associate with the presence of Hashem and everything good. And that's the idea. There was this matter, there was otherness, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu started to impose on that matter his presence. And it's a complex interaction which expresses itself in the physical matter of the body of a human being, which has been positively affected by all the formation and all the development which Hashem put into it, and especially by the ultimate insertion of the neshama, of the soul, into him, which is something which no other being has. But the dynamic is there, and the problem comes from the chaimer. The problem comes from the physicality. It begins with the physicality. It doesn't end with the physicality. It begins with the physicality. What do I mean it doesn't end with the physicality? You know, there's a famous exchange that the Gemara says between Antoninus and Rebbe. Who was Antoninus? Antoninus was Marcus Aurelius. Antoninus was one of the great Romans, a descendant of Esav, and Rebbe was Rabbeinu HaKadosh. Rabbeinu HaKadosh of Yehuda HaNasi, who was the greatest of the Jews. Esav and Yaakov generally fought. When they got along, so to speak, it was purely superficial, diplomatic. Yaakov wanted to be rid of him as soon as possible. There was one instance described so seriously and positively, and already alluded to, according to, if you read Rashi and Parshas Toldos, where they are born, of a very, very positive relationship between Yaakov and Esav, and that was between Antoninus and Rebbe, who literally, the Gemara says, were nafsho kshura benafsho. Right? It was their souls were bound up with each other, like you would expect twins to be. Instead of being fighting with each other, you would expect them to be very, very, very tight, very close. The Gemara says that Antoninus had a tunnel. Right? The Romans wouldn't take kindly to their great leader studying Torah with the Jewish Rebbe. He had a tunnel from his house to Rebbe's house, so that he would be able to go to him to learn. And because he was a king, he would never travel unaccompanied. So he would take a security guard who would travel with him, and when he would get to Rebbe's house, he would say, I'm sorry, but I have to kill you now. And he would kill him. Right? He would go through security guards like you go through tissues. right? So this was what he did because he couldn't travel alone. But on the other hand, right, you can't know what's going on over here. Antoninus used to lie down on the floor so the Rebbe could step on him to get onto his bed. And Rebbe said, come on, it's too much. You're a king. Antoninus insisted. Right, that was the Yaakov-Esav relationship which he had with Rebbe. Completely the opposite. Completely the opposite, in a sense, completely the ideal. There are a series of fascinating dialogues between Antoninus and Rebbe that you find in the Gemara. And fascinatingly, and again, it's, you know, the Torah is very, very big. It's beyond the scope of what we're going to be able to accomplish to talk about the whole thing. But you understand that you know, in shorthand, Yaakov was pure spirituality and Esau was pure physicality. Right? That was the problem here with these twins, that there was no balance, that one of them took all of this and the other one took all of that. And that's how you find their tremendous, tremendous schism and differentiation. And it's very fascinating that much of the discussion between Antoninus and Rebbe, or all of the discussion between Antoninus and Rebbe, does center around the physical-spiritual divide, the physical-spiritual relationship. So the Gemara says like this. Antoninus asked him, the Gemara is
something from Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Yeah, here you go. Okay. Tzadi Aleph, Amad Aleph in Sanhedrin. Omer le Antoninus le Rebbe. Gufu neshama yechelun lifter atzvei min adin. He said the body and soul can both escape punishment. How's that? The body will say, it's the soul's fault. Why? Ever since the soul left me, I haven't done a thing wrong. I'm just sitting here very innocently in the grave. And the soul will say, don't punish me, it's the body. Ever since I left the body, I'm floating up here with the angels. I'm terrific. It's all the body's fault. So the body will get off the hook and the soul will get off the hook. So where's the punishment going to come? So the Gemara says, Amar Le, Rebbe said to him, Emshel Chamashel Mo'adav. I want to give you an example to help figure this out. There was a king who had a pardes noah, who had a beautiful, beautiful orchard. And he needed somebody to guard the orchard. But he was worried because the people who would guard the orchard might take advantage of the orchard. So he put two guards there. One of them was lame and the other one was blind. And the idea was that, you know, the lame one wouldn't be able to get up and get anything, but he'd be able to see, you know, what was going on. Right? The blind one wouldn't be able to see anything, but he would provide whatever mobility. The Gemara says, so they were sitting there, and the lame one said to the blind one, he says, you know, this stuff is, there's some pretty good stuff up out there, and I can't get it, but you can't see it, so I have an idea. Let me climb up on your shoulders, or take me up on your shoulders, and I'll guide you and I'll tell you where to go, and together we'll go and we'll steal some fruit from the orchard. So after a little while, right, they did what they did. They picked the trees, bare. And the Bala Pardes, the king, came back and he says, my gosh, where's all my beautiful fruit? And they said, the lame one said, what do you want from me? I couldn't have gotten it if I wanted to. And the blind one said, what are you talking about? What beautiful fruit? Right? It looks the same as it did before. So the king goes and he says, let me go and I'll put the chigir, I'll put the lame one on top of the suma, on top of the blind one, and I'm going to give you lashes together. Right? Because that's the obvious combo over here, is the two of you together. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu also will bring the soul, put it together in the guf, put it together in the body, and he will punish them together, because indeed they were only able to do it as a combination. Understand this discussion between Antoninus Rebbe, this being of the physical and this being of the spiritual, right? It fits in. You'll see the whole pattern in the Gemara. Again, it's not time for, there's no time for us to discuss it at length. But this is the issue. So, says the Maharal, you know, you deal here with the chaimer, the physicality. The first stages, it's just chaimer, right? That water as it's forming, as it's developing inside the mother, it's just matter. It's just unformed matter. It's chaimer. The tzura, the shape, the form, comes at the end. That's when it gets its new shape, its new form. But the problem, in other words, the raw matter, which is really where the root of the problem is, and just that physicality, which is the otherness, which Hashem had to leave room for because it wasn't part of him, that is where the root of the problem is. The tzura, yes, it's true. They all will be punished together, like the lame and the blind man are going to be punished together, the 40. But if in some way you'd be able to together punish them and then identify and parse and divide and say, we got the chaimer, we got the matter, because after all, that's the heart of the matter, that's the core of the problem, then you wouldn't have to go to the tzura. Right? You're right, the chaimer without the tzura, right, it's nothing by itself. But on the other hand, if you would have the chaimer together with the tzura, and in a certain sense isolate and be able to completely deal with the chaimer, the tzura would then be, so to speak, free to go. And so says the Maharal, the way it works is like this. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Arboim Yakenu. Because he looks at the totality of the being and he says, the totality of the being needs to be punished. The totality of the being needs to face the consequence, needs to be purified, needs to be addressed, whatever it is that it has done. Arboim Yakenu, body and soul, form on top of matter. But then what happens? You start hitting it b'mispar, and you do it 1, 2, 3, 13, and then 1, 2, 3, 13, and then 1, 2, 3, 13. You've done it. You're going through one by one by one, and you reach the point of 39, and you say, you know what? 39. Was the chaimer, was the last stage of chaimer. We've addressed all of the chaimer. And so, all that's left is really the good stuff. And now we can stop. If you would give, if what happened was that that hooded fellow in the Bezdin had a strap. Okay, imagine this. He had a strap. And it was this wide. And on that wide strap, there were little straps, right? And they would go, instead of doing 1, 2, 3, 4, they would go kaboom, and they would get 40 lashes at once. There would be 40 straps on there, because you're doing it all at once. And it's the totality, it's the chigir and the summa, it's the lame man on the blind man, you're doing the whole thing together. But the Torah says you do it b'mispar. You do it one by one by one by one. And therefore, by the time you have completed the 39, the 40th, in a certain sense, becomes irrelevant. In the total, yes, there is that total picture of the whole thing. But when you then break it down, what you're really trying to address is the matter. And when you address the matter, and you, so to speak, purify the matter, if that's possible, then the form by itself, of course, is not posing a problem. That is the idea, the way the Maharal explains 40 and 39. That's the beauty of a Maharal explanation. It's not, it goes beyond just, okay, so now the technical reading of the verse, it says 40, but it really says approximately 40, 40-ish. You know, so say 39, come right out and say it. I mean, the Torah of precision. We want to say 40. We're in a sense fulfilling 40, but you understand that in the execution of it, at 39, you have reached the climax of what has to be done. The Maharal notes, and I'm just going to say this very, very briefly. The Maharal notes later in the piece, and this I mention especially only because it is relevant for us at this period of time, that we find a similar thing as well, where Sfiras Ha'Omer. We're supposed to count Tisperu Chamishim Yaim. We're supposed to count 50 days. And then it says, and what do we end up counting? We end up counting 49. We don't count the 50th day. And the Gemara over there also goes through all kinds of explanations of readings of the verse. How is it that we end up with 49 rather than 50? But he says the similar idea. Zeu soid ha-kosuv gam kein shomar tisperu chamishim. V'loi hoisa ha-sfira rak memtes. And so he says, is the when the pasuk says you should count 50, when really the count was what? 49. Ki ha-chamishim hu ha-mashlim. The 50 is the completion. Ha-mashlim ein ha-prati ve-ein ba-sfira. The 50, and this is also part of the way the Maral expresses it. Well, it doesn't say at. It says tisperu chamishim yoyim. If it says tisperu ad chamishim yoyim, halbatzar, half a problem. But it says count 50 days. But he says counting, like he says over here, b'mispar, is the idea of knocking it out piece by piece. It's knocking out piece by piece. And when it says tisperu chamishim yoyim, it's piece by piece. Once you get to 50, you're at the completion. You're at the whole. And the whole is a different story. It's not really subject to the parsing, to the separation. It requires more understanding there. Of course, it's not 40, it's 50. It has its own dynamic, its own shlemus, and we're not going to have time to go into it. I just want to say as a concluding word, a very, very gewaldige, very, very wonderful explanation from Rav Tzadik that's extremely relevant to what we're talking about here. I read to you this Gemara in Makkos, where the Gemara said, after the Mishnah, which said that it's actually 39 Malkus, the Gemara said, oh, I can't believe, look at these stupid Babylonians, that they stand up for the Torah and they don't stand up for the Chachamim. The Torah says 40 and the Chachamim say 39. So look how the Chachamim, they go and they interpret the Torah. And now, right, so they for sure should stand up for the Torah. They should stand up for the Chacham. Now there's a Gemara in Maseches Kiddushin. The Gemara in Maseches Kiddushin talks about the din, about the laws of honoring the Torah scholar. And the Gemara says, the Gemara asks, right, what daf is it on?
Right.
About Mal Lukami Lukami Sefer Torah. The Gemara asks, one of these. The Gemara says as follows. Okay, until I find it, we'll just go out. We'll just go outside. The Gemara says, "Do you have to stand up in front of a Sefer Torah?" So the Gemara says, "Yes, you do have to stand up in front of a Sefer Torah." How do I know? Because if the Torah says you have to stand up in front of a Talmud Chacham, how much more so that you should have to stand up in front of a Sefer Torah itself? So the question, which is obvious here, is that these Gemaras seem to have two opposite attitudes. On the one hand, here we're saying, if you have to stand up for the Torah scholar, how much more so you have to stand up for the Sefer Torah? But over there in the Gemara in Makkos, it said the opposite. The stupid Babylonians, they stand up for the Torah, but they don't stand up for the Torah scholar. If they stand up for the Torah, how much more so they should stand up for the Torah scholar? If that's the case, then we would never know to stand up for the Torah scholar. So the Rav Tzadik explains as follows. And he shows it in the Gemara. He says like this. There are two roles of Torah scholarship. There's one role of Torah scholarship over which the Be'er HaGolah would have been this thin. And there's another role of Torah scholarship, which is why the Be'er HaGolah is not this thick, because this is just one volume, but it's this thick, because I have three volumes like this, if you count the footnotes. One role of the Torah scholar is Moshe Rabbeinu told things which he learned to Yeshua. And Yeshua told those things to the elders, and the elders told them to the Nevi'im, and the Nevi'im told them to Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. And you go and you sit in a class and they tell you that Adam had a wife whose name was Chava, and they had two children, Cain and Hevel, and Cain killed Hevel, and Hevel, and then they had another child, Chase, and you store away all this information inside of you like a filing cabinet, and you'll be able to give it over to somebody else. That's one role, a significant role, we can call the role of Messiah, the role of giving over the tradition. I said it to you just now, an example, a written Torah, that's easy, it's written down, but let's say the oral Torah, when it was at least completely oral. Giving it over, the person stores the information. The other role of Torah, of the sages, which is where life gets much more complex, and we have the Be'er HaGola, is where the sages don't just give over what they heard, but the sages interpret, the sages institute, the sages create. That's a different role. That's where we get to a lot of our trying to understand the parameters of that role. Says the Rav Tzadok, the Gemara in Kiddushin is speaking about the Torah scholar who is what we call a Bor Sid She'enam Abetipa, a Sinai, a person who's just storehouse full of information. He listened to this Rebbe, he listened to that Rebbe, he remembers everything which he was taught, and he can give it back to you, he can give it over to students, pass it on to the next generation. The Torah says you have to stand up for him. You have to show him respect. So tell me something. If you have to stand up for the person because of the information that's contained within him, if you have the, so to speak, the body that represents that information itself, the Torah scroll itself, how much more so that you have to stand up for that? In him, it's still just a little bit floating. In the Torah, it's hard and fast. It's black on white. The Gemara in Makos, right? And there we would say that the Torah is greater than the Torah scholar. The Gemara in Makos is speaking about the sage who analyzes and develops, so to speak, and creates. Witness. What's the example? The Torah says 40, and came along the Chachamim, and they said 39. Says Rav Tzadok, there you are seeing the dramatic. In a sense, you are seeing that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave, like we learned earlier in the Maral, he gave the Chachamim the role to work with the raw material called Torah, and to control it, and to develop it, and to understand it, and to make an imprint, so to speak, on it. There, the Torah scholar does not stand as, oh look, he's carrying around the Torah, but the Torah is greater. There, farkir, the opposite, there the sage is taking the role of being on top of the Torah. There the Gemara says, for a scholar of that class, what we call an Oker Horim, a Mayan HaMizgaber, the one who creates, there we say, if you stand up for the Torah, how much more so do you have to stand for the sage who in a certain sense is over and affecting the Torah itself. That's what Rav Tzadok says. That's really the part of the role of the Chacham that we're learning about here, how they were able to read and to, in sense, mold our understanding and our approach of Torah. That's what Rav Tzadok says. There's a beautiful, that's the one which I wanted to share with you. I'll just close with a beautiful Hasidic Shavart that they say. So, you know, there's so many places, though, in the Talmud where this happens. Why did they make this comment here? Like, why didn't they make it by Sphira? So it says 50 and you only count 49. Stupid people, they do it. So the Hasidim say that the idea was because here, what did the Chachamim do? They used their power and they made life easier for a Jew. They said one less makkah, one less lash. That's a Chacham. Mir to Hashem, Mazel Tov. We finished the first well, and next week, Be'ezus Hashem, the netter, we will go on to Be'er Hasheni, and Be'er Hasheni is going to start to talk about things that the Chachamim say that don't seem to, at first glance, seem hard to understand, seem not to make sense. That's going to be the approach which he's going to have, which is a pleasure. Thank you.